The Bastards of Boston Baseball Podcast.
Back to Folk. Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champion. Game over, series over, and the Red Sox are world champs again.
Yes, indeed. Here it comes. Another edition of the Bastards of Boston Baseball.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
The Boston Red Sox with some fireworks on July 4th as they take the series opener versus the Washington Nationals by a score of 11-2. The offense shows up big for a Giolito gem. Excuse me. That's what I get for doing an early morning read. To raise their record within striking distance of 500 once more. As the dust clears, they stand at 44 wins and 45 losses. I'm Nick the Voice, joined today by Terry Cushman Jr., and we are the Bastards of Boston. And if you want more, you can go to bastardsofbostonbaseball.com for great written articles posted just about every day. Terry, where are we starting today? This was a beautiful game with a lot to talk about.
Yeah, and I remember looking at the pitching matchups and I'm thinking, well, Soroka's their best guy, so this is their most winnable game. And now, how many times does Giolito have to go out there and just completely shove before we're finally like, this is an automatic win for the Red Sox? Like, shame on me for thinking it was a winnable game.
Yeah, I mean, this guy, Giolito, you pointed out pretty early on that if you took those three bad starts and got rid of them, Giolito was pretty great. And a lot of people sort of clowned for that take and said, oh, well, if you take out anyone's bad starts, of course they're going to be good. But since that third bad start, he's on, what, five or six really tremendous starts. He changed his mechanics from what I heard, changed his arm slot. And since then, I mean, whatever he's doing, it's been working. I was kind of out on this guy relatively early, and he's completely proving me wrong, and I love it.
And, you know, a more increased emphasis on the fastball, too, has certainly been a factor. But, I mean, you go, I'm doing it on the fly right now. So in, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, in 6 of his last 8 starts, 2 earned runs or less. And the Red Sox have won 6 of those last 8 starts. So he's a guy that's just really put it together. I posted on social media earlier, you know, the White Sox gave up on him, sold him for bottom of the barrel. I don't even know what they got back from the Angels in that trade, but, you know, they gave him away for nothing, basically. Then the Angels flipped him to the Guardians after about a month or so, and Giolito had 6 to 8 starts there, and the Guardians especially have had a great pitching program for the last, I don't know, 15 or 16 years. Their pitching program has kept them relevant because they've never been an offensively robust team. Even that 2016 team that nearly won the World Series, it wasn't a hugely offensive team. So if you want to get fixed and address whatever's ailing you as a pitcher, the Guardians would have been that team to help him out. And it was a short sample size, so I mean, it shouldn't be a shocker that they couldn't fix him. But the fact that they had no interest in bringing him back the next season, which would have been, you know, pennies on the dollar, probably. I mean, there just was no interest. And the Red Sox ended up picking him up. And I think the Red Sox might have overpaid for him. He said there was very little interest in him. He said that in his press conference. It might have been a Zoom call, actually. That's how they do it these days, which I hate. I miss the old school press conferences with the flashy cameras. Like, man,
I'm with you.
The 80s and 90s were so great. But yeah, he said it was nice to be wanted and there wasn't a ton of interest there. So this was a guy very few teams in the league had confidence in. And I don't think we had confidence in him either, really. I mean, there wasn't, I didn't hate the signing, but I mean, it wasn't an automatic slam dunk. And then you lost him for the first year due to the Tommy John. And he had the bracing procedure and he's come back and the dude's been an absolute horse. And I think so many teams might be looking at it now thinking, man, you know, the pedigree was there and they didn't make a play like the Red Sox did.
No, absolutely. It's just nice to see. And it's getting to a point where I'm starting to think, well, hey, maybe that $14 million team option for next year, maybe that's actually something worth picking up. I think a lot of us had him written off as Kluber Part 2, and that's looking to be extremely unfair. If you look at the numbers, go back a month ago, June 4th, he has that terrible blow-up against the Angels. 1.2 innings pitched, 7 earned runs allowed. Absolute catastrophe. His ERA on the season is 6.42. Here we are, 5 starts and 1 month later. He has just pitched his longest game of the year, 108 pitches, 7.2 innings pitched, only 1 earned run allowed, for his ERA on the season to drop down to 3.66, 3 points nearly lower. Absolutely incredible, the dominance that he's been displaying.
Yeah, and, you know, Breslow is going to get calls on him, you know, as the deadline gets near. And the fact that he's essentially not a rental, he's not going to reach 140 innings. I mean, he missed a chunk of the season, and then those abbreviated blowouts that he had, there's been 3 of them. Those certainly didn't help his innings count. And he's probably at, just doing the math on my fly, about 66 innings right now. So what does he have to pitch here in the last few months? Let's see. Probably what, 74 innings. Well, maybe that's not. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. To reach that, it's 144 is the option, did you say? It's somewhere around there.
I thought it was 140. I can look it up here in a minute. But yeah, I wonder. That's interesting because if he reaches it, the Red Sox lose so much leverage here.
And oh, yes.
That's the painful thing. And because what I'm thinking here is my mindset before realizing maybe it's not all that many innings to go. My mindset was, well, you're going to pick up the option. And I mean, that's a steal at this point because he's pitching right now to the level of probably a $22 to $26 million a year pitcher. So for you to get him next year for 14, that's an absolute steal. And if you didn't pick it up, you're probably taking a huge chance on someone that's not proven and not, also not proven in a market like Boston. Not everybody can pitch in Boston. So that's a steal, but you could also leverage that into an extension. You know, maybe, I don't know what an extension would be, probably a 5-year deal, 5 years, 125. I don't know. I'm just spitballing, but you could hold him over a barrel and be like, well, we can just give you the extension now and you'll make a lot more money than $14 million.
Definitely. And you're absolutely right. It is 140 innings pitched. He is at 66.1 right now. That means he only needs, less than 74 innings on the rest of the season. If you figure that, he'll get five more starts in August, five more starts in September, four more starts maybe this month. I mean, he would really just need to average about, 5.2 to 6 to actually reach that point, which is very realistic at this point. So I think you're right. I mean, it's strange how the leverage so quickly can shift from everything being on Boston. Oh, there's no way that Lucas Giolito is going to hit that benchmark to suddenly, oh, wow, you know what? Yeah, he is probably going to get the chance to opt out. I mean, he's only 30 years old right now. He's looking pretty legit. That's what I got to say. I don't necessarily want to buy into it completely. God knows he's had good years in the past. But you're right about not everyone being able to play in Boston. And Lucas Giolito not only appears to be able to, but appears to thrive while he's here. I heard a quote on the air today that he says he loves this organization. He doesn't want to be traded. And that he feels like we stood by him when no one else did, which is sort of similar to what Paxton said back when we stood by him.
Another thing that another guy he kind of reminds me of, and not so much from a personality standpoint. It's important that I preface that because I would get roasted, but he's almost got a John Lackey type presence on the mound out there. You know, Lackey would give you three really good starts, and then the fourth one he'd get tuned up for 4 to 6 at least, and then he'd settle in for the next three, and you took that was fine. And he was a good postseason pitcher throughout his career, great postseason numbers. So that's kind of how I see Giolito out there. He's not really the number one at this point in his career. Maybe he does ascend to that, but that's just who he reminds me of from a performance standpoint. And Lackey wasn't really that great until 2013, which ironically was his first year back from Tommy John.
That is very interesting how that sort of works out. You know, not too long ago, I said that for this team to really take the next step, if we do want to be serious about being a playoff team, we needed a guy like Giolito or a guy like Bayo to step up, and both of them have been doing that. I would still think that we probably could go out and get another frontline starter, but as it stands, if the Giolito and Bayo resurgence is legitimate, that top three in the rotation feels pretty good. And when Dobbins comes back, if Fitz shapes up, this is looking pretty strong, even despite Buehler. The only problem with that is that, of course, everyone needs to stay healthy. But right now, the rotation is fixing itself, which is such a relief because the rotation was a big reason we were sinking so early in the season.
I agree with that, and I haven't really been that worried about the rotation. I know there are some people out there in the media and on social media, like, obsessed with the Red Sox getting another frontline starter, and that wouldn't hurt, but I don't think it's the pitching that's going to keep you out of it at this point. It's the lineup, and Dave O'Brien made a good point today, and I hate to give him credit for that because I hate him, and I still hope he gets fired at the end of the year, but he did make a good point by saying you don't have a bopper in this lineup outside of, I guess, Abreu, but
yeah. And Story, apparently
he's not an everyday guy. So you have to go get that Devers like presence back in the lineup. And I mean, you can't wait until the deadline. You got to do it fast. And so I don't know, but getting back to the rotation, you mentioned Crochet, Bayo, and Giolito. That's a great 1-3. If Kyle Harrison can just come back, if he develops that pitch, I forget which one they're having him focus on. It might be a sinker, or maybe that's what Houck's focusing on.
But a sinker or a cutter, I heard, with Harrison.
Yeah, it seems like the cutter has been the go-to for teams in the last few years. Like, give him a cutter, you know, and it ends up being an effective pitch and has transformed a few different pitchers across the league. But if Kyle Harrison comes back and he can pitch to the level of simply giving you a chance to win every time out, that's a pretty good rotation. And then I'm just boldly going to assume that Buehler, Dobbins, or Fitz, one of them will emerge. And or even Hauk. I prefer Hauk in the bullpen at this point anyway, just because, you know, another arm in there can't hurt. But I just think we're okay. I don't think we're going to miss the postseason because of our rotation. I think we're going to miss it because of the lineup.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. Now, what is interesting about this lineup? It's kind of weird because you're right. We are lacking power in a lot of ways, but it's kind of frisky right now. Some games will look like we can't hit to save our lives, but I'm noticing maybe an uptick in patience. It seems like even guys like Toro and Rafaela are walking more. They're willing to take that ball outside, not trying to play hero ball so much. This is the third series in a row now that specifically, it's big to point out since the Devers trade, that the Sox have dropped double-digit scores in a single game. We had that 15-1 win versus the Blue Jays, that 13-6 win versus the Reds, now an 11-2 win versus the Nationals. It's kind of interesting because I heard on the broadcast today, they were talking about how this lineup isn't necessarily top heavy, but it's not necessarily bottom shallow either. You know, really 1 through 8 are giving you pretty consistent quality at bats of similar quality. You have Duran hitting the ball better, Anthony getting going, Toro, who I thought, you know, he had a bit of a stumble there for a bit. I said, oh, here it comes. Here's where the regression comes. And since that, let me just pull this up. I believe he's hitting, 333 in the last 7 games. So he's completely back after that little stutter step. Narvaez, Abreu, Story's resurgence, Meyer putting up good at bats, Rafaela being one of the best hitters on the team. Really, the one black hole, only black hole, real weak spot in this lineup is second base, David Hamilton, who continues. I mean, the guy can't hit. The guy can't play defense. Somehow his defense is disappointing me more this season than his offense, I tweeted out. But once Bregman comes back and you have Meyer and Story shift over, and maybe Campbell takes that step forward and he gets called up back onto the team, and maybe, who knows, Eaton can be a guy who sort of takes a step forward. He's been okay so far. I mean, once we get David Hamilton out of this lineup, if we add a legitimate first baseman, just as an option, because let's assume that Toro does regress at some point, he has a bad month. If we go out, we get a guy like Ryan O'Hearn or a guy like Josh Naylor, this could be a very interesting, fun offense. It seems like the guys are just playing good baseball and enjoying it. But to counter that point, as much as the double-digit scores have been great, we've had some real stinkers of offensive performances too since the Devers game. You know, one run, two run type of performances, sometimes even being shut out. That simply is unacceptable.
Well, it's interesting. In the last week, it got reported that the Red Sox had changed their pregame approach when it came to meetings and strategizing, to where Fatsy and the assistant hitting coaches are now meeting with players more one-on-one for a more individualized, approach to that night's start based on whoever's pitching and probably, you know, based on what those hitters' strengths and weaknesses are. So, I mean, that's nice to hear, and perhaps that's been a factor in us turning it around. I've never been a fan of a one-size-fits-all program because you just can't, you know.
Yeah.
These guys all ascended to this level based on their own unique skill sets. So, and so many times this season, even earlier in the year when the pitching wasn't going well and it felt like Andrew Bailey was on the hot seat, that line from Moneyball just keeps ringing in the back of my mind when he says, nobody reinvents baseball. And, you know, and so many teams are trying to do it. And why? You know, the pitching lab has been blowing out elbows. Driveline, apparently, we don't talk about it much here. I'm not an expert on it, but apparently Christian Campbell is a big driveline guy, and look at him. Tristan Casas, another guy, was a big driveline guy. So just get back to just an old school mindset. I really believe that's what's going to win in the end. You know, the whole spin rate thing from, you know, 2017 through 2021 till they banned the spider tack. That was a thing, and teams did have to kind of, you know, adapt to that, but now that's gone, and I don't know. So I just think the, you know, switching mindsets and having these guys be worked with individually is probably what's helped them take a step in the right direction. Because you're right. I mean, there's not one guy you're really super down on. And when David Hamilton comes back, I don't think he's going to be in the lineup that much. I mean, you're going to have Bregman, Story, Meyer, and then your first base platoon. That's mostly going to be your everyday guys. And I don't know how you even sit Meyer for Hamilton.
Yeah, you can't.
When they're lefty. They're both lefties. So it just doesn't work. But I want to pivot to one other thing, because I mentioned it in either the last show or the one before that. I put the clip on TikTok today, which, you know, if you're on TikTok, go ahead and give that a follow. I'm super bad when it comes to putting the ticker on, so I'll do that now. But Trevor Story, when Bregman comes back, and perhaps this is only viable if we're at or under 500 as we approach July 31st. I think you have to dump him. You have to, if a team wants to do it, you have to get rid of that contract. And, you know, we were kind of on the fence, not in terms of wanting to do it, but in terms of how viable it was a couple nights ago. And perhaps it is a pipe dream, but I think it's at least gotten to the point where it's a valid question. If a team does approach you, should you do it? And his stock is rising. I mean, he drove in what, at least three today. He had a 2-run homer. I think he might have drove in as many as 4 actually, and just really swinging the bat really well. And I don't know. I mean, if you're in it, you know, it's a harder case to make as far as trading him, because he is a righty bat. You're weak on that, but I'll be curious to see if there's calls made.
It will be interesting to see. Ultimately, this is a guy who's coming off of June where he slugged 500, and this is in a league where slugging is down, on base is down. The offensive numbers, if you guys look up the league average player right now, it's a bad slash line. It's something that a few years ago you'd think you wouldn't even want to start. So far in July, 8 hits, one of them being a home run, 2 doubles. The guy is on fire. It's going to be interesting because, well, when the dust settles, we'll see very clearly who Trevor Story is, I think, by the end of the contract, by the end of the year, by really the end of this month. I think the further we get into it, we're going to see more and more. Now, my question for you is, how much money do you think would be worth eating? Because I don't see a team necessarily taking on all, I think it would be $55 million. Right now, he has 2 more years. His age 33 and 34 season are guaranteed $25 million a year. And then his age 35 season in 2028 is a team option, $25 million with a $5 million buyout. So $55 million guaranteed. If we did trade Trevor Story, and let's say we get good guys back, maybe, you know, a sort of triple A level pitcher that's maybe ready to take a jump next year, let's say, how much money would you be willing to eat off of that, do you think?
Well, if we're going to get legitimate prospects back, even if it's only one, I'd probably eat maybe a quarter of the money right now. You know, if a team was willing to take on the full ride, I would probably take a much lower package to free that up and, you know, and get that money off the books. I'm still operating under the mindset that we're not going to make the playoffs and we probably will have to sell. And if you can get that money off the books, the job is just going to be that much more attractive to the incoming executive because he's got a much cleaner slate. At that point, your only albatross of a deal is Masataka Yoshida, who will only be under contract for 2 more years. And I think his bat is better than Trevor Story's. And I know Story's been hot, but over a full year, Masa is going to walk quite a bit and hit probably a similar number of home runs. So I'm okay. If there's going to be an albatross of a deal on the books, I'm okay that it's Masa.
Yeah. And you know, Masataka Yoshida, he's a good on base guy. That's really what he's all about. He's the type of guy who's going to touch 300 average, you know, get on base, maybe 350, something like that. I think Story has been displaying maybe more power than Yoshida has. We haven't seen Yoshida take that jump, I don't think. What was the most home runs he hit? Was it higher than I'm remembering?
18 or 20, I think.
Oh, that's not bad, actually.
That was before the shoulder surgery.
Let's see. Looks like 15 home runs in 2023 in 140 games.
Oh, my bad.
And 10 home runs last year. That was only in 108 games. I mean, he slugs over 400, which again in this league right now is pretty decent. You know, Masa, there's something there. And I feel like if you do pair him with a guy like Ref Snyder, if you look at Masataka Yoshida's numbers versus righties in particular, he's very, very good. That's sort of similar to Story in the sense how Story sort of has his numbers elevated versus lefties, but obviously two-thirds of the league about is right-handed pitching. So Yoshida, $18 million a year for sort of a slap-hitting DH, we can survive that. And honestly, if a GM came in and really said, you know what, I don't think Yoshida is worth that, I mean, that's the type of money you could probably eat, you know, retain 90 to 100% of it, send it off to a team that could use a guy like that, and, you know, take like a lottery ticket on a guy in high A, you know? I don't think that's impossible. I mean, someone's going to have to go, unfortunately. Duran, Abreu, and Yoshida. You have these guys who prefer to hit right-handed pitching, who, you know, in theory, rotate between that outfield DH position. It's just hard to have three guys like that on the same team. You know, Yoshida's not really going to get you much of a return compared to Abreu and Duran. I hate to see either Duran or Abreu go. I agree that if we do become sellers, we're going to have some very interesting guys to get returns on. Giolito, Chapman, Story potentially. But it's such a shame because I'm at a point where I'm like, God, why can't this team be good? I don't want to see these guys go if we can help it. We're coming off that Blue Jays series. I want to go back to that series. 2 series ago where we took that one big game from them but dropped the series and we all felt pretty down. We said, man, this was winnable. Man, we really shouldn't have gotten shut out 9-0. We really should have had that 5-3 game that was so close on June 29th. The Red Sox, how could we do this? Well, the Blue Jays took that momentum and went into a 4-game sweep of the New York Yankees, knocking them out of first place. So it's starting to seem like maybe that Blue Jays series was not so much a reflection on us as it was a reflection on who the Blue Jays had become. Now you take a series versus the Reds, you start out strong against the Nationals, you wonder, can we carry out a sweep here? Can we carry that into that home series versus the Rockies? Can we get above 500 in time for Alex Bregman to come back? Aside from the Blue Jays, the Yankees, the Rays, who are battling it out, and we do have another series against the Rays coming up, I mean, we're better than 4 out of 5 teams in the American League Central. You have the juggernaut Tigers, and you have everyone else sort of bashing their heads together. I know, funnily enough, that division started very weak, got extremely strong right in the middle, and now it's kind of weak again. It's the Tigers and everyone else. You have the Astros' resurgence coinciding with the Mariners' decline, the Angels trying to be scrappy, trying to fight for a wild card as the Rangers and the Athletics start to lose hope as the series goes on. So you're finding the Red Sox in a really weird position strategically where, and I brought this up previously, I just want to see decisiveness. As much as selling will hurt, as much as buying could bite us in the long run if we don't make the playoffs, we fall short, I just want to see us commit. I don't want to see any of this soft buy-sell crap. I really don't.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I'm fine with if nothing happens up until July 28th or 29th. I'm assuming the deadline is on the 31st.
I would assume. I think it almost always is.
It's in July, I know for a fact, because there were a couple of years where it was August 1st or 2nd. But I don't care what they do up until then. But, I mean, if we want to win, we need to act sooner. Like, that's what should happen. But if we get to July 27th, 28th, 29th, that's when you make your hard move. You're either going to buy or you're going to sell. And I'm going to say this, and maybe it'll sound a little bit contradictory, but if it looks like Giolito is going to make it to 140, you need to try to get an extension in before the trade deadline. And I would extend him. I would make a hard effort at that. Of a deal worth 3 to 5 years, I would do that because you're just going to be looking for that guy next year, and you've got him now and he looks like he can do it. So I would go hard to do that. I really don't want to trade him. And the one thing that would give me optimism that he will sign the extension is if you type his name into Google, you're going to get 15 articles of him saying, I want to stay in Boston. Please don't trade me. I like it here. Use that. That's your bat signal. That's your bat signal to swoop in with the contract and get it done. I really don't want to trade him. I would trade one of Abreu and Duran if we do go hard in that direction to be sellers. I would trade anyone on a one-year deal, basically. And then I would definitely try to trade Story as well. The Bregman thing is interesting. We've gotten into that quite a bit, but, I think you could get a haul for him. We said last night, it was me and Chris, we had a really good, hot take show, and I haven't followed up on Muncy. Do you know if he's out for a while? Have you seen anything?
I mean, I would imagine he must be. That was a really nasty looking injury that he took. Let me see if we have a diagnosis right now. Only 6 weeks.
Okay.
MRI came back clean, thank God.
Okay. So I don't know if the Dodgers would definitely be in on Bregman because Muncy did play third. That's what he was playing at the time of the injury. The Tigers have Zach McKinstry at third as well. He's having a great year. I don't know if that's who he is or, if it's just lightning in a bottle type thing, but both of those teams do have a need for Alex Bregman, and the Tigers especially have to be looking at the Dodgers thinking, that's probably going to be our World Series opponent if we make it that far. And if it's like an arms race type thing, I don't think you can truly beat the Dodgers. And, your roster on paper is never going to look as good as theirs on paper. But if you add an Alex Bregman to the Tigers, that's an impact move for a plus-plus player with a championship pedigree. Being reunited with the manager that took him to one of those championships. So what I'm getting at here is if you can draw the Dodgers and the Tigers into a bidding war, you could get an insane trade package, I think, for Alex Bregman. So that's something that should be looked at. The one thing, as I said last night, that gives me pause about that is, see, I'm thinking the Red Sox have all the leverage here with Bregman, and perhaps I shouldn't say all the leverage at this point. Perhaps they have more leverage, but the thing in the back of my mind is, well, you traded Devers. Are you going to lose Bregman too? Like, optics wise, how does that look to start 2026 with neither one of them on the roster? So perhaps there could be some urgency there to retain a guy like Bregman, but I'd hate to see it happen, you know, where he finally gets that stupid contract after signing him to such a smart contract. You know, JD yep. Martinez, 4 out of his 5 seasons here, he made the All-Star team. And in, I think, a couple of those, he did fade in the second half. One of those was 2022, which was his final year. But every year, we just, it seemed like most of the fan base had an expectation that JD would opt out. And I think Boris tried hard. I mean, they have a 10 or 15 day window when the season ends to where they have to decide on whether they will or will not opt out. I think Boris went hard to try to find a deal for him to that would make sense for him to opt out, but that deal never materialized. So I don't know what kind of a deal is going to be waiting for Alex Bregman coming off of an injury, coming into his age 32 season. If I'm the Red Sox, I'd almost be like, you know what? Go ahead, opt out. We'll talk to you in February when you're still sitting there, and maybe we'll come to a deal that makes sense. But I don't know. It's just, this is a fascinating, probably one of the more fascinating Julys in recent memory since at least 2021.
I agree. There's a lot to think about. And you made a great point about the whole idea of a Tigers-Dodgers sort of bidding war, where both of those teams want Bregman. We know that. The Tigers tried to court him last offseason. The Dodgers have pretty much been writing it in big bolded letters that they plan on pursuing him next offseason. He would be a great fit, well, on most teams, really. The thing that I think held JD back that Bregman doesn't need to worry about is, if you look at the bulk of JD's playing time, it was as an exclusive DH in a major league where only half the league had the DH. I think that if the National League adopted the DH earlier, maybe JD would have opted out. Maybe he would have had more suitors. There would have been more competition. With Bregman, you have a guy who's not only a great hitter, but a great fielder too at third base. So I do think that there would be maybe more demand for him. I would just feel awful if, like you said, we do lose Devers, if we lose Bregman. We could have a conversation with Bregman and he could assure us, oh, no, I'm opting out for sure. I want to test free agency. I want to do this. And we trade him on the back of that. But we sort of did something similar with Mookie Betts. And obviously, you know, the whole thing happened with the 2020 season where it got shortened. And, you know, maybe that led Mookie Betts to say, you know what, I'll take the security now rather than risking it next year. But it would just suck to see Bregman do the same thing. And then the question becomes, well, who's our third baseman? Is it Vaughn Grissom? Because the organization doesn't appear to have a lot of faith in him. Is it Toro? I certainly hope not. You know, it really does become a bit scary to think about what this team looks like without a third base option.
Well, I mean, you're hopefully, when you clear this money off the books, you're hopefully going to have some free agent targets in the winter, and perhaps that's how you do it. I mean, Meyer could do it. I don't know if that really fixes anything, because who's going to be the shortstop? I guess Story still could be if we keep him, and then second base is kind of up in the air. But you're going to need – this needs to be a big winter for us with Devers off the books, potentially Bregman off the books. And I don't know if any other bigger money comes off. I mean, Bueller's going to come off. That's $18 million. Chapman is $10 million. But you would figure we're probably going to have to be active in the relief market anyway. So I don't know. That's why it's fascinating. That's why I keep pivoting back to how fascinating of a July this is going to be. It does make me kind of nervous that Breslow is still the guy. And I mean, he's won some trades. I mean, I think he just kind of got lucky with the Narvaez one. I don't think in even his wildest imaginations, he was going to get this type of production out of Narvaez. I think his expectation was Wong is our guy and he's going to start most of the games there. But yeah, so I don't know. They just have to decide whether or not they're going to be buyers or sellers. And I still question whether or not Breslow is the guy that's really going to figure that stuff out. Like if I'm Breslow right now, I'm on the phone with the Diamondbacks and I'm like, yes. Josh Naylor, what's it going to take? You know, I think this might be his walk year. So it's a rental yep. type situation. So what's it going to take, you know? And theoretically it shouldn't take much, but that's one thing I'm looking at. I don't know what's out there for second baseman, but that in theory won't matter actually. Cause if you're going for it, you're probably keeping Story. And when Bregman comes back, Myers, your second baseman.
Yep.
Let me say this, just to get on the Story thing. I might play him at second show other teams like, you know, this is what's possible. And Meyer's going to be there anyway. In fact, over the winter, I'm probably making that change. Meyer's my shortstop next year and Story's my second baseman if he's still on the books.
Without question. I mean, Meyer came up as a shortstop. He was heralded as the shortstop of the future. And I mean, that arm plays so well on the left side of the infield. He looks so comfortable. I think you want him to be the shortstop. Story has proven he can play second base in the past. I think it would only make sense for him to do it again. This year, his defense hasn't been stellar at shortstop. He's had his moments of good, but he's also had his moments of bad. So I don't know. I really would like us to see us shift Story over. I mean, I think that would give us the strongest possible team defensively. And God knows defense is necessary for this team.
I would do it tomorrow, honestly. I don't see what the harm is in just simply doing it tomorrow. Well, actually, maybe not tomorrow, but day one when Bregman comes back, then I'm doing it. And they're teasing that he could be back on the next homestand, which I think is right after this series, actually.
Yes, it is. I believe you're right. Let me double check that. We are here, and then, yes, we are going home on July 7th. We will be hosting the Rockies and then the Rays before heading out towards Chicago. So speaking of the Rockies and what's upcoming, let's look at what's upcoming versus the rest of the Nationals. Take a look at probable pitching. We do have a Bueller day tomorrow, unfortunately. He will be pitching against Mitchell Parker. That has been announced at 4:05 p.m. The next day, it is a Crochet day, starting a 1:35 p.m. start. No determined pitcher for the Nationals. A couple names we might see, I think I had them pulled up, aren't guys that I know too much about. Right now, I know that they're just coming off a doubleheader of their own, and that kind of messed with them. Let me just search this up here. How are you feeling about the Bueller matchup tomorrow, though?
Oh, is that tomorrow?
Yep.
I thought that was Sunday. Not good. You know, someone pointed out on social media, well, if Giolito can turn it around, then so can Bueller. But the difference is Bueller's fastball was getting crushed. And late last year, I think it was a slider that is what changed things. And with Giolito, it was the opposite. You know, he was mostly off speed and then he pivoted back to the fastball. So I think it's kind of an apples and oranges type comparison. But I don't know. I mean, he's the same exact age as Giolito. So you would think there should be something left in the tank, but they haven't figured it out. And at this point, even after a couple good starts, I don't know if he's even going to be movable at the deadline if you wanted to try to do that.
Yeah. It would be bad, you know. Bueller versus Parker. I mean, Parker's not a good pitcher. That's the nice thing. I'm pulling up his numbers right now. You look under the hood. Only 62 strikeouts in 91.1 innings is a terrible rate. His hard hit percentage, is, wow, apparently in the fourth percentile. Am I reading this right? 49.7% hard hit, right? Apparently. So
brutal. Yeah.
That's really, really bad. I mean, you look at his expected ERA, 5.41, his actual ERA, not much better, 4.63. He last pitched on June 29th, had an okay start. I mean, his last three starts have been better, but I mean, even his last start, three earned runs off of six hits and three walks and five innings. That's not what you want to see, certainly. If the Red Sox are going to get Buehler a win, tomorrow is a pretty safe matchup for that, I would say. I'm not necessarily predicting it to happen, but I mean, this Nationals offense is not good. You know, they have Abrams, they have Wood. They're very fun players. I know Alex Call, I think his name is, can be kind of a frisky player, kind of fun. But you look at sort of that 5 through 9, very weak, maybe even 4 through 9. You have Lowe, who isn't exactly living up to expectations. Bell, who's not good. What's the kid's name? Brady House, I think, has not taken a step forward, I think, like they've wanted him to. So, you know, if there's a candidate for a team to bounce back against, Buehler getting this Nationals lineup could be one of those. And then for Crochet, I have two probable pitchers that Nats haven't decided yet, but you're looking at Kyle Hendricks, who last pitched on June 28th. Jack, I'm going to butcher this last name, Kokonowitz, something like that. He last pitched on the 29th. I would imagine they probably go with Hendricks. Kyle Hendricks, despite not looking great over the course of the season right now, he's had a very good June, a 3.21 ERA last month in five starts. Let's see here. Looks like 21 strikeouts in 28 innings. So not a big strikeout guy, but, you know, limiting damage, certainly. Whereas poor Jack over here, I mean, a 6.31 ERA in June. I would imagine Hendricks would probably be the preferred. Regardless, you got to feel good about a Crochet start, right?
Absolutely. I know he got touched for what, 4 or 5 in the last one, but he had immense run support. I think that was the game where the rookie was tipping his pitches there.
Yeah.
But this is a much different lineup from what the Reds were trotting out.
How are you feeling about these next two? Do you think we can get a sweep or just a series win, or do you think we're in for a heartbreaker?
Well, I think you're certainly going to get a series win. If Buehler can suck considerably less than that Parker kid, then perhaps a sweep will materialize, but I'm not going to bet the farm on it.
Yeah, I think that's smart too, because I mean, you look at Buehler in his last 7 starts, he has a 9.29 ERA. It has not been good. I'll say I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm willing to sort of wave the flag and say, woo, let's sweep them, get above 500. I would not at all be surprised if tomorrow's a blowout against us.
Yeah, and it's not just Buehler versus the Nationals. It's Buehler versus himself in the Nationals. You know, he's in his own head pretty bad. And so that's what gives me considerable pause when trying to make a case for him winning.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to see. I mean, if he can materialize just some nice, you know, mechanics, try to figure out what Giolito's doing. I heard that Giolito likes to load up MLB The Show the night before a start and go through the opposing team's lineup to get a feel for them, funnily enough. Maybe Buehler should camp out in his room tonight and, you know, go through together and see what the Nationals look like in the game.
Play Madden instead. Just turn your brain off. Just use a different part of your brain.
Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a fun day, a fun episode. Definitely reason to celebrate on July 4th. I've been Nick, joined by Terry, and we have been the Bastards of Boston. Take care, everyone. Thank you, and farewell.